Good evening, everybody. I'm Becky. I'm an alcoholic in recovery from alcoholism and a few other things. So Julie and I had devised a pretty intricate plan to burn sage and chant in an effort to make you all go home. But then we decided we'd get our AA card yanked, so we ditched that plan. I do think that possibly at this moment we should all take a big deep breath so that I feel better. Angel, thank you so much for this opportunity that I didn't even know I wanted. When Angel asked me to tell my story, I think I cringed and tried to say no. But my AA training said that we never say no, and it clashed with my Al-Anon training that says say no often. So, in any case, here I am. You know, but I thought, okay, no worries, I'll just come up with an excuse and back out. And then I remembered steps 6, 7, 8, and 9, which I kind of think of as the becoming and being different steps, the letting go of old behavior steps. So I chose to embrace this opportunity to rise above my fear of imperfection and my fear of boring you all into a coma. So should you feel that you are going feel a coma coming on, do feel free to step outside to smoke or have a nap or whatever you need to do. Somebody will catch you up when you get back in. This has actually been a wonderful opportunity for remembering and reflecting. I've told my story several times over the past 25 years, but never in true sobriety. So there's a teaser. I once had an 11-year period of physical but not emotional sobriety in Alcoholics Anonymous, which shall henceforth be known as my long period of false sobriety. I have to say, you guys are in for a much better story than the last one I told, because I relapsed after those 11 years, and I went out and got myself a whopper of a story. So here you go. That story did, in fact, bore people into a coma, so you're safe. My friend Damon here tells me that there are three stories: the one that I think I'm going to tell, the one that I actually tell, and the one that I wish I had told. So honestly, I have no idea what you're about to hear. I'm going with the tried and true method of what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. My husband told his story a couple of weeks ago and very cleverly used the 12 steps, so that wasn't available. So I'm going with the old standard. I don't intend to spend a lot of time talking about the years between age 16, when I discovered the magic of alcohol, and age 39, which is when I began my 11-year period of false sobriety. Instead, I think I'll tell you just enough so that newcomers can identify with my drinking. I'll tell you about my relapse period and the events that led to a genuine divine intervention. And gosh, the absolute happiness that I feel in this very true emotional sobriety that I've been graced to find. You know, I am very, very grateful for all that period when I was not truly sober, because I have, you know, like there has to be dark in order to understand light, there had to me had to be that period of sobriety that wasn't real. So I grew up in what I thought was a normal home. As a matter of fact, until I was about 39, I thought that we were the Beaver Cleaver family. Thank you. Somebody here is old enough to remember Beaver Cleaver. The mom vacuumed the house wearing pearls with all of her full makeup on. No, actually, there was no drinking, no active alcoholism in my home at that point. I do have to add this. My mom would go on much later in life to drink alcoholically, make it to AA, and we'll celebrate 28 years sober next month. So I'm really proud of her, and we kind of have AA in the genes. I was a very, very, very good kid. I was, you know, on a roll. I was a middle child. I was a peacemaker. You know, I was helpful around the home, never caused anybody any trouble. But now, you know, looking back, I was anxious as hell. I heard a speaker say once that she was such an anxious child, she should have had a beer on the way to kindergarten. I say, right on. So, warp forward to age 16. I found myself a 20-year-old boyfriend who could buy me alcohol, which made me one happy and relaxed girl. As you all know, alcohol makes one beautiful and witty and sparkly and smart, and it quickly became the social lubricant that I needed. I have to say here that my relationship addiction, which has been every bit as detrimental to my health as alcohol, started very, very early in life, even before I started drinking, probably about the same time as I should have been having that beer on the way to kindergarten. I was of the generation that was basically screwed by the Cinderella and Prince Charming myth. Seriously, I could quote every line from Cinderella and just live for the moment when the prince kissed her. You know, truly, I fully believed that a guy on a white horse, a cute guy on a white horse, was going to ride up and make me happy. You know, started believing that about age 5. Fast forward, I got married at 19. I got divorced at 21. I went to nursing school and started a career. I got remarried at age 25. I had 2 sons, who are awesome humans, and divorced their father at age 37. As you might imagine, my drinking progressed and just got worse over time. You know, I don't really need to tell you. I think that if you're sitting in this room, you understand how it progresses over time. Because I was a psych nurse, that's what I did for the 35 years of my nursing career. I knew about AA because I had taken any number of patients to meetings. Along the way, I made a stab or two at AA, so I possessed a big book, which I thoroughly enjoyed reading with a glass of wine in my hand, thinking all the time, boy, these guys are on to something. But not now. When I started losing my car in bar parking lots and knocking the doors off of it because I forgot to close them before pulling out of the garage, and panicking because I couldn't find my 8 and 10-year-old sons when they weren't in their bed in the middle of the night. Spoiler alert, they were in their bed in the middle of the night. They were just at their dad's house, who wasn't as drunk as I was, and panicking because they weren't in the house. This was the point when I reached what I would later come to know as step zero. This shit has got to stop. So I came to AA, and I did all the stuff. I did steps with a sponsor. I attended meetings. I chaired meetings. I sponsored other women. Did service work. You know, and life got so much better for the next 11 years. For all the reason that life is better when alcohol isn't in it. No more messed up car doors. No more throwing up red wine on white bedspreads. No more forgetting where my children were. No more handing out detox medicines to patients with my hands shaking worse than theirs. No more driving kids around with a glass of wine and a koozie, and so on and so on and so on. But there was no psychic shift during this period. There was no spiritual experience. There was no admission that I had no control over most everything else in my life. No recognition, indeed, that I was not God. I searched for it. I searched for God. I intellectualized. I tried everyone else's conception of God on. I called it by many names. I went through a period where I called it Ted. Don't know why. Can't imagine. But I never let my barriers down enough to feel anything like higher power flow through me. And it was really frustrating because I saw people who had what I wanted, and I just couldn't get there. My attempts to control took the shape of trying to control how others felt about me by trying to figure out what they needed and how they wanted me to give it to them. So my perfectionism was all about trying to control how others saw me. And I did a really good job. I mean, I was a really, really good actress during that period and later on. You know, that was a process that started really, really young, you know, back when I was a kid thinking that, you know, a man was going to fix it for me when I was 5. I wanted what other people had but couldn't find it, so I settled for the next best thing. I found the sickest, most dysfunctional, pathological liar I could find to make my higher power. And I think this is where my husband Forrest would like for me to tell you that it wasn't him. Indeed, it was not him. It was not him. I knew you were sitting there thinking that. But I would spend those 11 years in that emotional chaos and dysfunction not drinking. And it was not the unhappiest time of my life, but very nearly it. So, you know, however strangely, when I got rid of he who shall not be named, you might think that things would have gotten better, that I would have found some happiness, you know, but no. Remember, no psychic shift, no connection to a true higher power. So I did what any self-respecting, dry drunk, and Alcoholics Anonymous would do. I started drinking again. An interesting part of my relapse was that I had started Al-Anon while I was with my pathological liar to try to figure out how to deal with him, even though he wasn't an alcoholic. I thought, I don't know, this might work. After attending a few meetings, I contorted their wisdom into my belief that since I had been sober for 11 years and that most everybody in my life at this point was an alcoholic, that probably I was just an Al-Anon and not really an alcoholic. So, how convenient. Talk about, you know, delusion and dishonesty. But so the next 7 years would be the story that we all know. Drink, stop, start, come to AA, get a year sober. You know, because I still had not reached enough of a bottom to recognize, you know, that there was a power higher than me and I wasn't it. You know, pretending to be sober, you know, and attending AA meetings while you're drinking is just excruciating. You know, I just really don't recommend it. It was exhausting. So this is the point, actually, where I make a public blanket apology to all the rooms for my dishonesty, you know, and my living amends are staying truly sober and passing on what I've found to others. You know, here is also where I share one of my favorite Bill W. quotes from page 17 of As Bill Sees It. I guess it came from somewhere else before that, but the deception of others is nearly always rooted in the deception of ourselves. The deception of others is nearly always rooted in the deception of ourselves. You know, it's just it is amazing to me that I could so deceive myself and not even know it. You know, I would have told you, and everybody in my life, I think, believed, you know, that I didn't lie, that I was the nicest, most honest woman around. Yeah, that's how lost I was. That's how out of touch I was with myself. I had no idea who I was at my core. I had no connection to my own spirit. I know that there was a spirit self there, but my egoic self was just totally in charge. You know, I was such a good actress. I really should have earned an Academy Award. And then, on September 17, 2017, God said, "This shit has got to stop." By this time, I had to drink around the clock. I mean, like, truly, wake up in the night, you know, just to get a few more hours of sleep, just to keep withdrawal symptoms at bay. Oh, and I must say, I thought I was managing just fine. Until I woke up in the emergency room of the hospital where I worked with a stroke nurse talking to me. It's like, what? I thought that I had just gone out for lunch to make my customary alcohol run. And as it turns out, a few hours earlier, I had been discovered by a coworker unresponsive in the parking lot, laid out on the concrete beside my car. Most of that day was a blackout, except for the part where I tried to elope from the hospital to make my way home as if nothing was amiss, only to be apprehended in the parking lot by an oh-so-helpful ER nurse who returned me to the locked portion of the emergency room. Yeah. You know, I was no stranger to locked units, but I had always been the one on the other side with the key. Yeah, so this was a bit of a wake-up call when I found myself unable to leave. You know, indeed, my plan, talk about crazy, insane alcoholic behavior, my plan was to mention nothing of this to anyone, resume my work schedule the next day as per usual, you know? Wrong. but back to the ER, where the doctor informed me that I was lucky to be alive, that what was coursing through my veins on that day, which was supposed to be 100% blood, was actually 50% blood and almost 50% alcohol. My blood level was 0.449. Here's how the scale goes. 0.080 is definite impairment of muscle coordination and driving. This is the legal intoxication level in most states. 0.120, vomiting usually occurs. 0.150, balance and movement are impaired. This is the equivalent of half a pint of whiskey circulating in the bloodstream. 0.200, most people begin to experience blackouts. 0.300, many people lose consciousness. 0.400, most people lose consciousness and some die. 0.450, breathing stops. This is a fatal dose for most people. 0.449. I mean, it's a miracle that I'm standing up here before you, able to construct a sentence and a fairly cohesive talk. I don't know what happened that day. I don't have a clue as to why my body didn't die. But after the prolonged fog that followed that day cleared a little bit, I had an exceptional moment of clarity. There was something mysterious and all-pervasive that decreed that I belonged in the world, that I had not done what I'm here to do. And what I'm here to do is to love myself and to love other people and to help them. I firmly believe that that's exactly why I didn't die. I'm really actually kind of surprised that I didn't emerge from that episode with a tattoo of the 12th step on my forearm. I would not have been surprised. I need to speed things up here. I guess I should tell you that was the day that I let go of my nursing career of 35 years. I did go to Ridgeview to the Impaired Professionals Program, and I could have gotten my license back, but I took that opportunity to reinvent myself. I had always felt like a fraud as a nurse. I do have to tell you, because apparently I do still care what people think about me. The period where I was going out every day, drinking at lunch and buying my supply that I had to carefully hide before I got home and blah, 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 blah. I was not taking care of actual patients. I never drank and took care of patients. For the last 10 years of my nursing career, I was a paper push-in nurse on the phone with insurance companies trying to get more time approved for the patients. But I had always felt like a fraud. The way I decided to go into nursing was I was working in a psych hospital in the pharmacy, and the pharmacist, at the ripe old age of 20, I was contemplating divorce and knew I was going to have to be able to take care of myself. So the pharmacist I was working with goes, "Why don't you go to nursing school?" And I go, "Okay," because that's how I made decisions back then. I was just looking for people to tell me, which direction to go, what to do, and how to do it. But deciding to leave nursing was an important major step for me, because I was totally consumed by fear of financial failure. And that was when I took my first faith-based step of understanding that if something had saved me, from death, that something would see me through, financially. So that was what it was like and what happened, and this is what it's like now. I thought coming back into the rooms, humbly and honestly, was going to be hard, but it was so not hard. It was so different, because I was so different this time. I mean, that crash and burn was the bottom that I needed. Getting that close to death was what had to happen to me to make me different. I came in here with true beginner's mind, and it was like when Dorothy and the Wizard of Oz, sights the Emerald City, and all of a sudden it goes from black and white to technicolor. It was like, yeah! That's exactly what this experience of sobriety, has been like since 4.5 years ago. Words in the big book, it's like, oh, that's what they meant. Oh, now I get it. So anyway, my old sponsor graciously took me on, and we started over with the steps. I attended a lot of meetings, and dealt with the shame, you know. But there was no shame in these rooms because everyone in them was just open-hearted and kind and gracious. So thanks to all of you for that. You know, I developed a daily practice that was pretty brief there in the beginning because I was working in a law firm. You know, and here's how crazy I am, my expectations of myself and perfectional. I thought that I know nothing about the law, mind you. You know, it's like I don't even know the difference between a plaintiff and whoever the other guy is. Defendant. There we go. I remembered. But I fully expected to walk into that law firm on day one and go into court and try a case or something for an attorney. You know, that's how crazy I was. So, you know, I'm having to get up really early to go to that, but it was imperative that I establish some kind of spiritual practice, which was really brief. But, you know, among meditating and reading AA literature, I added The Language of Letting Go by Melody Beattie because I knew that my core issues revolved around my codependent stuff. You know, I drank to ease my codependent shit. Anyway, I want to put in an endorsement because 2 years into my sobriety, I dove hard into Al-Anon to augment my AA practice. And, man, my emotional sobriety really took off. You know, Bill talks about AA being spiritual kindergarten, and I found that to be true for me. I just, I needed more in terms of addressing my emotional life as the wife and the daughter of recovering alcoholics. I know, don't know what you may or may not have, you know, heard about Al-Anon, but there's often a misconception that one attends so that they can help the alcoholic in their life, and that is so wrong. I attend Al-Anon to learn how to take care of myself within, you know, the relationships with the alcoholics in my life, as well as all the other people in my life. I won't sponsor women these days who won't agree to my bringing Al-Anon into our work. It's just that important to me, and I think it makes me a better sponsor. One of my favorite things in the big book is on page 84, where he says, "We have entered the world of the spirit. Our next function is to grow in understanding and effectiveness." I love that. You know, I firmly believe that we're meant to keep learning and growing until we draw our very last breath. You know, I hope I never get there. You know, there's always something more to learn and pass on. I've watched my own evolution over the past 4.5 years. With a lot of awe and wonder. And it's a progressive recovery for a progressive disease. One point of Buddhist philosophy is impermanence. You know, everything is always changing, right? And as alcoholics, well, as people in general, I think, you know, we really hate change. But what a paradox that is, because that's what AA is all about. It's like, you know, change everything, right down to, you know, the core level, right down to the cellular level. You know, we root out old ideas and behaviors that put us in a position to hurt ourselves or others. So the happiness and emotional sobriety that I enjoy today has required a lot of study, and I'm here to tell you that AA has just an enormous amount of valuable literature. And one of those pieces of literature that I don't hear mentioned a whole lot in meetings is an article that Bill published in the 1958 Grapevine about the ongoing challenges of recovery that he faced long after he stopped drinking. As a matter of fact, he wrote it 24 years after he got sober. It's called Emotional Sobriety, The Next Frontier, and I highly recommend it. It describes Bill's insight that his struggle with depression was due to overweening. I'm quoting here, and I had to look up overweening, and it's synonymous with egotistical. So his depression was due to egotistical dependencies on other people and outside circumstances. You know, I love this because it really matches up with my expectation that happiness was going to come from outside myself, you know, from a man or a child or a job. You know, he goes on in that article to say, and I quote, "Because I had, over the years, undergone a little spiritual development, the absolute quality of these frightful dependencies had never before been so starkly revealed. Reinforced by what grace I could secure in prayer, I found I had to exert every ounce of will and action to cut off these faulty emotional dependencies upon people, upon AA, indeed upon any set of circumstances whatsoever. then only could I be free to love as St. Francis had. Emotional and instinctual satisfactions, I saw, were really the extra dividends of having love, offering love, and expressing a love appropriate to each relation in life. You know, what resonates so deeply for me about this excerpt is that it boils everything down to my higher power and me. You know, it's like everything else can fall away, but as long as I maintain that connection, you know, and live in that, you know, I'm golden. I think God is love. It's funny, when I was a kid, you know, that was kind of a saying. It might have been on a commercial or something, but, you know, I think God is love with a capital L, you know. And, you know, remember back to the spectacular crash and burn that I came through with a moment of clarity that followed. You know, I am supposed to be here to love myself and to love others and to be of service. I keep stressing love for myself first, because I am just a very, very staunch believer that I cannot give to anyone else what I don't have for myself. You know, I can't give love to other people if I don't have it for myself. And I certainly can't give sobriety or help other people with sobriety if I don't have it my own self. You know, I tried that and it didn't work. I don't know why I want to say this, but I do. You know, there is no need for me to be a big fish in the AA pond. My responsibility is to be a kind and compassionate fish in the AA pond, and to channel as much love as I possibly can to as many people as I can. And boy howdy, when I put this intention out there to the universe, whoa, did the souls needing loving kindness ever show up? Inside and outside of the rooms. I added a line to my morning thing that said, you know, may I be a good human and a good conduit of divine energy. And man, the service opportunities rolled on in. But I love it, because this just provided a burst of incredible energy to my spiritual growth. You know, it's just such a ride. You know, if you're new and your sponsor tells you that that they learn as much from you as you do from them, believe them. Every single time I work with any of the ladies that I'm mentoring, I grow by leaps and bounds, you know, and my heart just gets so full I can hardly stand it. You know, we all know that, you know, service is one of the ways to maintain spiritual fitness. Other things that I do are daily spiritual practice. For me, that's yoga and metta, which is just means sending the sending of positive energy and kindness toward others. I have added a practice that I'm so excited about. It's chanting. It's a chant. Back to that chant that we were going to run you out of the room with. I am exploring Nichiren Buddhism, which is, I have discovered, it's a movement for world peace, like truly a religion devoted to world peace. And I am jazzed. So if somebody makes the mistake of asking me to speak again, you'll be hearing more about that. You know, gratitude and saying thank you. I'm surprised I get anything done all day long. You know, from the minute my eyes pop open, I am saying thank you for another day, because we are not guaranteed anything other than what we have right now. You know, I say thank you to the azalea bush, you know, for putting out some buds that are about to be beautiful flowers. And I say thank you to my body that I nearly destroyed and it didn't quit on me. It's, you know, that's very important to me. I say thank you to my food, because, like, it took so many people, you know, interdependence. It took so many people to get that food on my plate. You know, I want to stop and add here my continuous gratitude to my husband, who opened my eyes to the incredible and indescribable beauty of the West. You know, I'm so grateful for every step and every decision, good and bad, that led me to the Buddhist 12-step meeting where I met him, and, you know, and where our life started, and the life that we've created, and all the adventures we've experienced, and everything to come. You know, another thing that's really important to my sobriety is spending time in nature. And Forrest and I take our grandson up to, well, outside, up to Red Top Mountain, you know, and we get to watch this little human unfold. I mean, it is miraculous. It's, you know, yeah, people who don't believe there's a God, you know, get outside, look at some nature, look at a kid, you know, just watch it all unfolding. simple prayers are another thing for me. I have never been one for rote prayers or religious sounding prayers. So I do have to tell this story. Back when I was still drinking, I would listen to audiobooks on my way to and from work, and I looked in my library one day, and there was a book in there called Hallelujah Anyway, and I thought, what the hell? I would never have paid money to download that thing. I'm technologically challenged so bad. Tried to get that thing out of there, couldn't do it, so I thought, okay, fine. So warp forward, I become sober, I look in there, I listen to it, and it's amazing. It's by Anne Lamott, who identifies herself as one of us. And reading that book led me to another book, which is like everything. You know, everything leads me to the next thing that's just woo. But that one led to a book of hers called Help, Thanks, Wow, The Three Essential Prayers. And, you know, that was awesome. It's like, yeah, I got the prayer thing covered now, you know, without a whole lot of verbiage. The last thing I want to talk about is time spent with kindred spirits. You know, that's absolutely essential for me. And it's, you know, kindred spirits, you know, for me are outside of these rooms. I do want to say something about in these rooms, though. You know, namaste is a Buddhist term that means the divine in me sees the divine in you. And as you know, this is a we program. So finding AA meetings that feed my spirit is essential to my well-being. If you're new, understand that all meetings have a personality. You know, if you encounter a meeting with a personality that doesn't agree with you, find one that does. You know, for me, if my spirit isn't being fed in a meeting, it's not the meeting for me. Some people need kick-ass sponsors and kick-ass meetings, and no, not for me. I've always responded better to kindness and gentleness, so that's the kind of gathering I look for. I again put in another plug for Al-Anon, because those kindred spirits, you know, show me what it's like to have a happy, peaceful life, living with their qualifiers, whether the qualifier is still drinking or using or not. These folks have peace and calm within the storm that I want. So I surround myself with those people too. You know, as Jeremiah mentioned, we have a group that gets together to meditate and study the 12 steps from a Buddhist perspective. You know, I'm delving into Nietzsche and Buddhism. One of the women that I'm working with and I are studying adult children of alcoholism and dysfunction, you know, so that I can learn, you know, what about their scope and how the 12 steps look from that angle. So, you know, I have to take it beyond these rooms. I mean, it started this room, you know. AA got me sober, you know, but my happiness is just, you know, multiplied exponentially, you know, by taking it outside the rooms. You know, further than that, study. You know, there's just no end to the interesting things to learn. You know, before I came in here, I wasn't interested in anything. Mostly I was interested in climbing into the skin of whatever man I had captured and figuring out what he liked so that I could take that on. I was a tofu person. Anybody familiar with tofu? It's that soy substance that has no personality of its own. It truly takes on the flavor of whatever you cook it with, and that was me. But man, no more. I am interested in everything. I have more books than I could read if I lived to be 110. You know, it's like, it's about crystals, and it's about Ayurveda, and it's about chakras, and it's about herbs, the legal ones. And, you know, just to name a few, but, you know, I remember distinctly the day in sobriety when I realized that the possibilities are absolutely endless, you know, in sobriety. And, I'm going to explore everything. You know, I want to learn about everything, and I am no longer concerned with whether I look like a nut doing it or not. I used to be so ruled by what others thought of me that I didn't even know, you know, what I thought of me. I didn't know what I liked. Recovery has given me the most important relationship of all. It's given me a relationship with myself, a place where the divine lives. I know the Bible says that the kingdom of heaven is within, so I figured that must be where God is. right here inside of me in the fourth dimension. Thank you all for sharing this evening with me and for listening to me. Yay.